All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all very much. Please be seated. Well, good morning. On behalf of the Idaho Supreme Court, I want to thank you for joining us here today in the new part of the Kootenai County Courthouse. By statute, the Idaho Supreme Court is required to travel throughout Idaho to hear cases in communities across the state. We do this not only to fulfill that legal obligation, but also because it gives us the privilege of bringing the work of the court closer to the people we serve. Today's sitting provides an opportunity for those present to see firsthand how justice is administered at the state's highest level. And we hope that these proceedings will foster a greater understanding of the rule of law and the vital role courts play in interpreting Idaho's law. We're grateful for the warm welcome of the Coeur d'Alene community, for the excellent facilities here in this new part of the courthouse, and for the ongoing partnership of local judges and court staff who make our work possible. So with that, we will proceed to the first case on the docket, which is Nelson versus Wiley, number 52008. The appellant is Larry Nelson, here represented by Brennan J. Schreibman. The respondents are two separate parties, if you will, two separate groups. Therese Wiley and Chanel Wiley are represented by Zachary W. Jones, and Leslie Wiley by John A. Finney. Counsel, do any of you have anything preliminary to the court in this matter?
Just very briefly, Your Honor, as I was preparing for today's argument, I had a chance to find a handful of citation and quotation errors in the appellant's reply brief. And nothing that alters the substance, nothing that changes the propositions for which they're cited, Scrivener's errors, and I just intend to file an errata sheet just for candor to the court.
Thank you for that. We'll expect to see that errata sheet filed. Thank you very much. With that, Mr. Schreibman, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I've reserved 15 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, the petitioner, Larry Nelson, worked for 35 years maintaining the marital home of himself, that belonged to himself, and his wife, Gwenna Mae Riley Nelson. After Ms. Wiley Nelson passed away in 2022, he was left with his grief, but on top of that, he had questions about what was going to happen to the marital home, what the value of his interest in it was, and how the estate would be administered, given the provision of the will that gave him a life estate. The co-personal representatives, after the opening of probate, began renting out the property for which he had a life estate and retained the income. The property has, it's been indicated that it will not be devised to him after the conclusion of his life estate. So he brought this tethered petition to get a declaration saying what, if any, is his community portion of the property and how should his rights under the estate be administered.
Was that declaration clear in their new original pleading or in the proposed amended pleading?
It was in full. So the first pleading, the first cause of action was construction of the will, which is a necessary part of it. I mean, to distribute it, you do have to construe the will, and then the statutory basis was declaratory judgment in that first one. And then the second one was made a little bit more explicit with respect to the specific causes of action.
And that one was never filed. It was offered but never accepted by the
court. Yeah, it was filed. The petitioner sought leave to amend, and the amendment was denied for reasons that are kind of wrapped up in the the district court's dismissal of the federal proceeding.
Maybe there's obvious reasons that weren't stated, but as a surviving spouse, why didn't your client participate at all in the probate proceeding?
Because he, I guess, just as based on the record, I mean, he didn't have to. Title 15 sets out a myriad ways of contested proceedings, ways of resolving disputed issues. TEDRA is not the only one.
Right, I agree. And I understand this case, of course, is going to be about the TEDRA option that you chose, but I'm just curious, is there a reason I'm missing why, as a surviving spouse, you wouldn't be involved from the get-go in the probate proceeding?
You or your guess, I don't know. Before filing the petition, believed this provision in TEDRA that allows for the filing of a separate action, the petitioner believed would be the best avenue to get a clear and efficient answer.
And again, if you don't know, you don't know, but why did they reach the conclusion that a separate action under TEDRA was the best option?
It was petitioner's belief at the time that the probate proceeding would be more adversarial, hostile, and involve a lot of discretionary acts by the co-PRs. And admittedly, there's a bad feeling on both sides. And so because TEDRA offered a separate avenue for filing a separate proceeding, which could then be consolidated, if the court wanted to handle it that way, that's the route the petitioner went. And so the under Title 15, there's numerous ways to adjudicate contested proceedings. TEDRA is one of a couple. The proceedings are, it says in Title 15, Chapter 3, 107, each proceeding before the court and registrar is independent of any other proceeding involving the same estate. The very opening provision of TEDRA, 15.8.101, says that this chapter, meaning Chapter 8, also provides for judicial resolution of disputes. If a non-judicial resolution is not obtained, there are alternatives to the other provisions for resolution of contested matters under other chapters of Title 15. From that sentence there. And then it concludes with, the provisions of this chapter, meaning TEDRA, shall not supersede, but shall supplement any otherwise applicable provisions and procedures contained in Title 15, Idaho Code. And the whole first section of TEDRA 101, 102, 103 describes the district court's plenary power to adjudicate, full and ample power and authority to administer and settle all matters concerning the estates and assets of incapacitated and missing, including matters involving non-probate assets and powers of attorney, and then subsection B, and this is in 15.8.102. The estates and assets of deceased persons in subsection 1A. And the matter includes any issue, question, or dispute involving the determination of any class of creditors, devisees, legatees, heirs, and also the direction of a personal representative or trustee to do or abstain from doing any act in a fiduciary capacity, and the determination of any question arising in the administration of an estate or trust or with respect to any non-probate asset. And it also includes the construction of wills, trusts, devolution agreements, other writings. Importantly, in all of these provisions here in the beginning of Chapter 8 of Title 15, an important definition is the definition of court. that is used at the in the preliminary chapter of Title 15, which is on Title 15.1.201, subsection 8. Court is defined as a court or branch having jurisdiction in matters relating to affairs of decedents, omitted. And this court in this state is known as the district court. So all the references in TEDRA are referring to the district court. All the plenary, full, and ample powers that it describes are referring to the district court. And a person with that specifically enumerates that has standing to sue and bring a TEDRA proceeding is set forth in 15 in TEDRA, 15.8.103, subsection 3F, which it says, surviving spouse of a decedent with respect to his or her interest in decedent's property. And for the, with respect to the procedure for TEDRA, Idaho Code 15.8.202 says that a judicial proceeding under this chapter may be commenced as a new action or as an action incidental to an existing judicial proceeding relating to the same trust or estate or non-probate asset. And then subsection 3, once commenced, the action may be consolidated with an existing proceeding or converted to a separate action upon the motion of the party after good cause shown or by the court on its own motion. And so here the district court could have opted to consolidate the matter with the existing probate proceeding. The court could have continued hearing the matter under its own jurisdiction. But what the court could not do was find that it did not have subject matter jurisdiction under TEDRA and then dismiss it.
If the court had done the consolidation route and consolidated it with the underlying probate action, does that mean then the case would have returned to magistrate court and been presided over by the magistrate? Or would, does that mean the district court would have taken over the probate?
So my, that's a good question. So my understanding is at least, preliminarily, the probate proceeding would have continued on, and this would have been stayed until the consolidation took effect, which I believe is under a separate separate statute in Title 15. And I don't know the answer, I can't cite a statute, but my gut says magistrate.
The reason I ask is, as a district judge, when I had a request to consolidate cases, they were usually two cases that were in front of me, not a request to consolidate a case from another judge in another level of the court system. And I'm just curious, is this what TEDRA intended, was to allow district courts to pick up and take over a probate? Or did it mean that the district judge could turn a district court action into a magistrate probate action? I'm just not sure what avenue the rule intends.
Yeah, it does not mean that. The purpose of TEDRA is to provide an efficient and swift mechanism for the resolution of disputes and other matters. It is nowhere in TEDRA does it say it or even suggest that it would give district courts the ability to pick up various probates.
In fact, it says it won't supersede, but supplement.
Yes, yes. And a lot of judicial districts have dealt with this with different judges by local rule. I know District 4 has a local rule concerning consolidation. The district, they're the first judicial district presumably do that, but there's nothing in here that says the district court can usurp pending probity cases. And so the procedures for that are not in the statute. They would have to be devised more locally, I imagine. Importantly here, in the amended petition, that sought a variety of claims, for it to got rid of the cause of action for partition after understanding that that was not a cause of action that should have been pled because it ultimately is up to the PRs to distribute the estate, and however they deem to do that in conformity with the law, partition shouldn't be ordered by the court, but it did add other claims for conversion, ouster, and declaratory judgment, and that was just made more explicit, although it was in the first petition. And
was petitioner seeking a jury trial on any of the? I just realized some of those issues wouldn't be amenable to a jury trial, but on the ones that were, was a jury trial requested? Because I realized TEDRA allows that.
Yes, I don't know. I don't have it in front of me. I believe it did, but I'd have to double check that. I think it's on. It starts at 8 in the clerk's papers. Is the initial petition. These supplemental claims are also capable of being adjudicated under TEDRA, given the court's power here. That's the case for Zell versus D. Young, which is in 163 Idaho 473. And then the amended petition, the original petition and the amended petition, both stated viable claims for relief under TEDRA. What petitioner sought is her determination as to the value of his share of the community, of the increase in the community property that was attributable to him. And he is not seeking transmutation. I mean, that can't happen. Idaho was a title state. And so the house itself was the decedent's separate property because she owned it prior to the time of marriage, which she got for $40,000, which is referenced in the will, which is why the cause of action for will construction was added. But over the next 35 years, the petitioner did upkeep, did improvements, paid taxes, all the work associated with keeping up a home. And under the string of Idaho case law, Bliss versus Bliss, Suckhan versus Suckhan, the Gapsch case, there's string sites in each one that recognize that when community labor and community efforts are invested in, even in a separate property asset, then the appreciation in value is a community asset.
Is there a difference, though, between mere maintenance of a property and improvement to a property? In terms of whether some of that is attributable to, well, in your client's situation, to community efforts or investment?
Yes, sort of. So when it is, there is no right or entitlement to a separate asset, and the phrase is to, if it sits idly, or if it just naturally appreciates through its own by virtue of just being there. So an example from the Gatch case is an investment account that was.
That's not what I'm talking about. If you don't mind my interrupting, I'm talking about the difference in a house and, you know, maybe the builder's paint is getting a little worn, so you slap a new coat of paint on, versus replacing the flooring. versus maybe taking down some walls and, you know, making a bigger master bedroom. There's a difference, you know, there's maintenance on the one hand and something that changes the character, finishing the basement, for example, changes the character of the house from what it was before. Is there a difference there in what a person in your client's position could claim under the theory that it was community effort, assets, money that went into making this investment versus, yeah, we live in a house, we need to maintain it?
I suppose it would help if I listened to your question, Justice Meyer.
That's okay.
Yes, absolutely. Unlike an investment account where funds sit in an index fund and naturally appreciate through no maintenance, no moving funds around, a real property is the largest suction of entropy that in which the quote-unquote maintenance, in a sense, is not at all the same. Index funds, they just sit there, you watch. If the maintenance were not to go into the property, it currently would now have been worthless. If the taxes weren't paid on the property, there would have been a tax lien and a tax foreclosure sale by the county. All of the work, even putting improvements aside, all of the work repainting the house, all of the, by your example, replacing, not replacing the flooring, but keeping up the lawn, replacing beams when they start to rot and they get old, all of that is necessary to preserving the house so it can appreciate.
Go ahead. Do we even get to that issue at this point where the procedural status of this case, it was dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction? I mean, I share Justice Meyer's questions, but when you're at this early stage of the case and you're talking about, is this the right kind of claim that can be filed under TEDRA, it strikes me we don't get to the merits. Instead, shouldn't we focus on whether this is a matter as defined in TEDRA?
Great point, Justice Son. No, it's too early to get there. The whole idea of
it's too early to get where?
To get to the merits of
okay.
It. Yeah, that was just to illustrate with respect to the motion to amend the TEDRA petition. The standard is whether or not the amended petition could state viable claims. And here the district court dismissed it on the grounds that it was futile because there was no subject matter jurisdiction. There was subject matter jurisdiction here. And so it states a viable claim, which is the whole point, which was my whole point for that frolic there. But the relief the petitioner is asking for is not on the merits of the claims. It's just to find that the district court erred in dismissing the case and denying leave to amend based on a finding that there wasn't a jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you. We will hear from Mr. Jones first.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Zachary Jones. I'm with Lacey Law, and I represent the state. I have responded in this matter. One of the co-personal representatives, Chanel Wiley, is also behind me today. Just a little bit more background about this matter. The decedent, Glenna Wiley Nelson, was married to the other respondent's father, Les Wiley. And they acquired the two parcels in question in the early 80s, late 70s. And one of the parcels has a home on it, and the other parcel, which is a separate, buildable but vacant lot, directly adjacent to the first parcel. It actually serves kind of as a yard, but it is a separate buildable lot. After Les Wiley's death, the decedent subsequently married Mr. Nelson, the appellant in this matter. And during that marriage, the properties remained the decedent's separate property throughout the entirety of the marriage, and the decedent passed away with a valid will. There are essentially three issues before the court today. One, did the district court dismiss the correctly dismiss the petition pursuant to 12b-6? Wrapped in that is the question of whether or not the district court correctly denied the motion to amend the petition, and then finally the question of whether the district court correctly granted the attorney's fees. The question of whether or not a motion to dismiss that's reviewed de novo, and the other two issues are reviewed from abuse of discretion. The initial petition in this matter raised two causes of action, essentially, the declaratory judgment and partition. The proposed amended petition withdrew the partition action, but kept the declaratory judgment action intact and added two other causes of action, conversion and Halsberg. The gist of the petition was a declaratory judgment asking that the district court find that the appellant had a community property interest in pursuing separate property.
So why isn't that, to Justice Zahn's question, why isn't that a matter? As it falls under TEDRA.
Absolutely. So matter is defined under TEDRA, this is 15A103, as a determination of persons interested in the state, the direction of a personal representative to do or abstain from any act in a fiduciary capacity, and the determination of any question arising in the administration of an estate, including questions related to the construction of wills. It's our position that the appellant is unreasonably stretching the definition of the word matter. In this case, the petition alleges no dispute that the appellant is a person of interest. The petition alleges no allegations that the personal representatives have breached their fiduciary duty, and the petition and that the terms of the will are clear and unambiguous. And so it's our position that TEDRA does not have jurisdiction because this is not a matter.
Why isn't it any question arising in the administration of the estate?
Because the property is clearly characterized as her separate property, and she has the authority to devise her separate property as she sees fit.
Right, but as I understand it, his complaint and the amended complaint seek some sort of distribution to compensate for what he asserts was a community endeavor, community interest due to the increase in the value of the property. Now, it may turn out on the merits, you know, the legal theories don't work and the facts don't support it, but just what he's seeking strikes me, it is any question arising in the administration of the estate. The estate should pay me. The estate should give me more.
I would submit that that's still not appropriate for TEDRA. That would be appropriate for probate action, and there was no action brought in probate action.
Well, and I'm focused on, I understand your argument. I'm focused on the language of TEDRA, and I understand the arguments in the briefing that this just doesn't make sense to construe TEDRA this broadly, but I am applying the plain language of TEDRA, and so that's why my questions are focused on why isn't this any question arising in the administration of the estate?
Well, I believe that that's in 15A102, and the key word there is that that's matters relating to the administration of the estate, and so then we need to move to 15A1031, which defines matters.
No, it's language. It's 15A1031C.
I guess there's a sub-list of provisions in there, including the construction of wills and others. That
says include without limitation. So it's a list, but it doesn't define the universe. It's saying it can include these things, but it's not limited to these things. I mean, the language of 15A1031(1)(c) includes the determination of any question arising in the administration of the estate, and it also includes any question with respect to any other asset or property interest passing at death. And it strikes me potentially as pled. The complaint falls under both of those. Now, there may be no merit to it, and so when you get to the merits, you may be able to dismiss on that basis, but just on jurisdiction, I'm struggling with how that language defining matter doesn't, these claims don't fall under that.
Well, with respect to the second one, I would submit that that he has no community property interest in these properties.
And isn't that a merits? Sorry.
Not exactly the same.
Well, I mean, even if we are getting to the merits of it, it's still, the complaint or the petition still alleges relief that, or a request for relief that can't be granted because the petition alleges a community property interest in these separate properties, and there is no community property interest in these.
But isn't that a question of law, not a question of jurisdiction?
Sure, but I think that the court can still find that, the district court can still find that even if it has jurisdiction, that a 12b6 motion is appropriate because no relief can be granted.
See, that's what I'm not understanding. If taking it outside of TEDRA, if somebody files a terribly worded complaint, crafted poorly, clearly a loser case, can the court dismiss it because it's such a badly, poorly written complaint that it doesn't even have jurisdiction?
If the court finds that the court, that the petition or the complaint does not allege any relief that can be granted, I think we can dismiss it under 12.
I guess what I'm saying is, doesn't the court have jurisdiction to dismiss a bad complaint?
Yes, I believe Your Honor is correct. The court has jurisdiction to do that. I mean, I guess we're arguing alternative theories. A, the court doesn't have jurisdiction under the definition of matter under TEDRA, but B, even if the court does have jurisdiction, it properly dismissed this because the petition failed to plead or relief that can be granted.
And I didn't see where the district court addressed the 12b6 ground, but you're arguing since you asserted it below, we should, even if we don't agree with the jurisdictional grounds, go right, result, wrong theory, and address the 12b6 ground that I don't think the district court addressed.
Yes, I think that this court can move on to that. That's this court's position. And that's certainly our argument, and was our argument below, that even if the court has jurisdiction, the 12b6 is still appropriate.
And because it was a 12b motion, there were no declarations or evidence presented in connection with the motion. You want us to decide it based purely on the pleadings?
The motion was argued completely on the pleadings and the declarations included.
Speak up a little bit, Mr. Jones.
Of course. The motion was completely on the pleadings. There were no declarations included. So it's a true 12b6 motion. So the will in this matter, which was attached to the petition, is unambiguous. It devises the parcel with the building on it, the home on it, to the respondent, Leslie Wiley, with the life estate to the appellant, Murray Nelson. And it devises the other parcel, the vacant parcel, directly and expressly to the appellant, Leslie Wiley. The terms of the will are clear. The fact that the will has a provision where if Mr. Nelson and Mr. Wiley choose to sell the parcel with the home on it during Mr. Nelson's lifetime, that Mr. Wiley, that they divide the proceeds equally, but Mr. Wiley gets an additional $40,000, that does not create an ambiguity in the will. The testator's intent was clear. And objectively, the intestator's intent makes a lot of sense. She was trying to do right by her previous husband, her first husband, by devising the property that they acquired together to their son. And she was trying to do right by her second husband, her current husband, by allowing him to live in the property for the remainder of her life. So there's just really no ambiguity with respect to the testamentary intent. And then moving on to the question of separate community property, again, it's well established that property acquired prior to marriage is separate property. Even in a divorce action, the court has no authority to award one property separate property to the other spouse. Now, that can be subject to reimbursement, and I think that's the question that the appellant is getting at, but that does not change the character of the property. Transmutation of the property cannot be presumed, and it must be proven by clear and convincing evidence, and statutory formalities need to be followed, i.e. the conveyance of real property needs to be in writing, and no such allegations were made in the petition.
Justice Mueller asked a question of the appellant, which was basically, you know, why pursue TEDRA? Why not pursue a matter in the probate action? Do you have any observations regarding that? What happened?
I don't have any insight. To be perfectly candid, I kind of wondered that myself. But I think I would submit that the petitioner or the the plaintiff is the one who's in charge of the complaint.
Sure.
And it's not the respondent's position to kind of guide that. So I think that's a good question, but I don't know what I'm going to say for that. Finally, we discussed TEDRA, so I'll move on to the attorney's fees. It's bottom line is that in our opinion, or our position, that TEDRA cannot transform the separate character of its property, and that it remains the decedent's separate property. As such, the district court's award of attorney's fees was proper under 12.21. The district court found that the petition was brought without foundation. She distinctly found that it wasn't necessarily frivolous, but again, I think that the implicit finding is that it was the wrong cause of action that was brought, and that's kind of leads to the question of why wasn't anything done in the further action. Further, the district court properly awarded attorney's fees under the TEDRA action. The TEDRA statute, that's 15A208, that provides the court broad authority in awarding attorney's fees. And this court, in committee of the Ariz Mendez, granted that to the prevailing party. We would submit it to the prevailing party below. This action was brought under TEDRA. The relief was sought by the appellant under TEDRA, and attorney's fees were under TEDRA applies.
Counsel, let me ask you, I recognize that you've acknowledge that the motion to dismiss on jurisdictional grounds is a de novo review for us. If the court in this case had recognized, yeah, TEDRA gave me jurisdiction, but I really think this should better be resolved in the probate, so I'm going to order this consolidated or sent back to the probate court for resolution of these issues. Would that have been reversible error if the court had said, yeah, I do have jurisdiction, but I'd rather have the probate court resolve this?
I think that would have been an interesting question, and it kind of leads to the question that you asked the appellant's counsel. And I'm not sure that the probate court, I think that the probate matter should have been probably joined with the TEDRA matter had these been consolidated, because I'm not sure that the magistrate court would have jurisdiction over the TEDRA matter.
Right, and I guess what I'm getting to is if you're correct on the jurisdictional issue, then the trial court here wouldn't have had authority to say, I'm going to find that I have jurisdiction, but I'm going to send it back to the probate court. Is that your position?
No, I think our position is that the trial court, if it found that it didn't have jurisdiction, it would dismiss it.
No, if it found that it did have jurisdiction.
I think it could still dismiss the action under 12b-6, and a separate cause of action could be brought in the probate action.
I guess what I'm getting at, are you saying that the court didn't have jurisdiction to determine that although it has jurisdiction, this case would best be resolved in the probate court and send it there?
That's a little bit confusing, to be honest. I do think that the court should it have had jurisdiction under TEDRA, then it would have had jurisdiction to remand the matter to the probate court. However, the district court found that it didn't have jurisdiction, but even if it did have jurisdiction, I think that it...
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say, please correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying that the court would have erred if it had said, I have jurisdiction, but I'm not going to hear this. I'm going to send it to the district court, to the magistrate court for probate proceedings. You're saying that would be error. Is that correct?
To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure. I want to put a lot more thought into that before I answer your honest question.
Well, and doesn't TEDRA purport to allow the transfer of an action to join it with another pending probate action? Isn't that 15.8.202?
Yes, I believe that. Any other questions?
Here's no. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Finney?
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel. As indicated, good morning. I'm John Finney. I am here representing Leslie Wiley, the son of the decedent. And I think everyone in the room is quite aware of all the relationships, who represents who. So I'm going to skip ahead to some of the questions here. So first, to address the questions, the motion brought by the estate is the record page 72. It is a motion to dismiss pursuant to Rule 12b-6 for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. What more of that would be on the laptop here. To answer the questions, I think that the word jurisdiction in the district court's reasoning and rationale was not a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. It was, this is not a cause of action that the court can proceed on. The word jurisdiction was thrown around, and I would assert that the district court does have plenary jurisdiction. Any recognized cause of action, the district court has jurisdiction over. And to kind of jump around to some of the questions, the magistrate division is a division of the district court. It's not a separate court. It's part and parcel of the district court. It has certain limited matters that it has jurisdiction over, some of which are monetarily, have dollar limits, but divorce, probate, there is no monetary limit. There are no other limits. So to answer the direct question, I believe under TEDRA, the district court has jurisdiction. That would be my client's position. The court used the word jurisdiction dismissing the case, but really the court was, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, right outcome, wrong reason. But well, I think that's the wrong word.
Counsel, let's look at what the court actually said in the bench ruling then, because I suspect you're right. I think the court started on the right path and then meandered off perhaps into error. The court said initially, I do think that the proper forum for this question is a probate case. I'm not convinced that I have jurisdiction. I do not find that I have jurisdiction. So the first sentence, I think, supports your theory, but the next two sentences are pretty clearly a finding of no jurisdiction.
The word jurisdiction is clearly stated, I have no jurisdiction. But based on arguments and the motions brought before the district court, I think what the real underlying decision or thought process was, this is not a cause of action, therefore I can't proceed on it. Now, that would be a much clearer record.
Is cause of action the right word, or matter the right word for when you're in TEDRA?
Sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
Is the cause of action what we should be looking at, or whether this is a matter as defined in the statute?
Well, a matter has to be based on a recognized cause of action or a claim. I can't say I want to know what color underwear someone was wearing. That's a matter that the court could proceed on that. There's no cause of action or there's no matter to determine something that's beyond something that relief can be granted. So,
well, I would push back a little on that under 15.810.3.1c. A matter is defined as the determination of any question arising in the administration of an estate. That seems pretty broad to me. Any question?
I don't think that courts answer questions unless they're justiciable under a recognized cause of action. Maybe better example, because I was thinking very quickly there, but an adjudication to say the moon is the sun, or the sun is the moon, there's no justiciable issue that's resolved by either of those. So just because the legislature in TEDRA used a very broad sentence and definition of matter, any question, we don't sue on questions, we sue on causes of action.
No, but it's a question relating to the administration of an estate, or a property interest. Is a property interest in reimbursement, or is an interest in reimbursement a property interest?
I would assert not in a marriage dissolved by death, which is what we have here. We do not have a marriage dissolved by or being dissolved by divorce. The attempt is to try to take a divorce cause of action, of which you have rights to adjudicate, and apply them to a decedent when there was no pled, a divorce pending at the time, nothing. So what's happening is trying to apply a cause of action or a question that doesn't apply to a decedent's estate. Title 15 makes no provision for any community right of set off on the division of assets, which is part of a divorce.
Are you suggesting that community property law isn't applicable in a probate proceeding?
No, I'm asserting that community property law as part of a divorce, which is the dissolution of the marriage and division of assets and liabilities, is not part of a probate proceeding.
So in a probate proceeding, is it unusual for a magistrate to make determinations, especially when you're involved with a second marriage, about community and separate property? Is that an unusual thing to ask?
I guess I would bluntly say I've never seen it asked. Now, I haven't handled every case in the state of Idaho, but in my experience, almost 30 years, I've never seen that issue raised in a probate proceeding. I would assert if I had a client with that type of circumstance, the probate proceeding is to distribute the assets in accordance with the will after going through the creditor claim period to satisfy. Now, if in this circumstance, I'm not here to coach the other side, but I think the appropriate procedure is the probate will distribute the property by a personal representative's deed to my client, subject to a life estate in favor of the petitioner. And if the petitioner wants to sue at that time and say, I have more than a life estate, I'm suing for quiet title, wants to assert these divorce concepts, that's the method or mechanism to assert it. I would assert the outcome's the same. There's no community property claim based on a decedent's estate with a clear will.
But if there had been like a, I mean hypothetical here of course, but if there had been like a prenuptial agreement, that would certainly be relevant in a probate proceeding, wouldn't it?
I don't know that, yes, back to this jurisdiction, yes, there could be jurisdiction based on a contractual claim under a prenuptial agreement for some outcome, but that's not what's alleged here.
I guess I don't see this case as being extraordinarily unusual. It seems like a lot of the contested probate proceedings we have involve second marriages, and the children from the first marriage not happy about someone trying to claim the later spouse making a claim for more than they think they're getting. These kind of cases are pretty common in probate court, aren't they?
Not based on my experience of this nature of asserting a community property claim. There may be other assertions, but not that I've handled. I guess just blank ones. I didn't take that approach in my research and reported appellate decisions, but all of the case law cited are appellate cases of spouse v. spouse that have been cited in this case, as far as my recollection is. They are not estate proceedings of this nature.
And so I'll grant you, Mr. Finney, the court's ruling on the motion to dismiss it's confusing. I mean, there's subject matter jurisdiction discussion, but then we have a dismissal without prejudice, which suggests it's something else, but dismissal without prejudice also suggests it's not a 12b6 decision either. And part of what's confusing to me is it appears the district court is just saying, I think this is better dealt with in the probate proceeding, which I completely understand, but I don't know what 12B basis that, 12B8, I don't know. And so that's part of my struggle here. Another part of my struggle is I'm not sure why the motion to amend was denied. I know there's been an assertion that the district court decided the claims weren't viable, but I don't see that anywhere. So can you point me to somewhere in the record, either the transcript or a pleading, that explains why the motion to amend was denied?
The best answer I can give you is just what you cited to me, where the court said, I'm doing this without prejudice to any rights. I think what the district court, sometimes we have used the term punt, was punting to say, if there's anything here, it's not in front of me. It's in front of the magistrate. It has to be within the scope of the probate proceeding. That's my takeaway from the arguments, the dialogue, the words that were used in total, viewing it in total. But no, there's no clear thread to point you to in the record.
And so if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying the parties moved based on 12b-6. But it doesn't appear that was the basis for the district court's decision.
I think it is. I just think the district court was inartful in some of the words used, or not clear in the way it got to the ultimate resolution. But the ultimate resolution was, this is not properly before the district court.
But I don't see any assessment that these weren't viable claims, or there was a failure to state a claim, which is where you started, that this was properly dismissed because none of these were viable claims. I don't see any analysis of that in the district court's decision. Or is it somewhere else and I'm not seeing it?
No. There were very, I don't want to say limited proceedings, but no, we have a very short, concise transcript of the arguments. We do have the moving papers that did assert those, which is all part and parcel. Just because something is discussed during the argument portion doesn't mean it's not a basis for the ruling. So, but beyond that, no, there was no express exchange or recitation or announcement of decision that clearly says, I don't view these as viable causes of action. What I understood the court to be saying, I don't have jurisdiction, was to say that, but that's not expressly what was said. I would say that some of the terms used can get us to right decision, wrong wording, or wrong legal term.
I think for me, when I think about how to sort out the district court's ruling in this case, there's a big difference between saying there's no validity to the claim, and that's 12b-6. I mean, you know, you haven't pled it. It doesn't compute. This is not a legally viable theory. Versus, this is better handled in the probate matter. Those are two very, very distinct paths. And ultimately, isn't what the district court did said, go see the probate court? And if that's the case, that was a jurisdictional ruling. That wasn't a 12b-6, you ain't got nothing in this complaint kind of ruling.
Yes, I would agree that the court's analysis went towards where should this be heard. And that's why I think the court used the words jurisdictions. I don't think that amounts to reversible error in what the court decided in the case.
But if that's the case, then that's not a 12b-6 determination, right? I mean, a 12b-6 is you lose.
Yeah, we're not here arguing they can never be heard again. We're here on an appeal of the district court's decision that the district court was not proceeding on this. So, and I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. I'm trying to answer your question, but yeah, so we're not here. Although the motion was brought under 12b-6, we did not get an adjudication out of the district court. This can never be heard because it's not a cause of action. We agree with that. But what we're here on is that decision reversible error, or is it a proper decision either the way it's phrased and stated on the record or with some conflicting language? Did the court get the right decision for the right reason, but maybe use the wrong word, or got the right decision for the wrong reason?
Doesn't that require us, though, to do part of the, if we were to do right result, wrong theory, how can we get there without this court doing some fact-finding? I mean, if we conclude that, the district court clearly had jurisdiction, but they could never have won the case. That's going to require us to do some kind of a factual inquiry, isn't it? Is it proper for us to do that on appeal?
I don't know that there's any genuine issue of material fact. So on the standard as set forth in the brief review of the district court's decision on a motion to dismiss, it's the same standard as the review of a motion for summary judgment being granted. And so as a matter of law, I do believe this court, as a reviewing court, could rule that there is no cause of action for a divorce principles applied to a decedent's estate. I think the court could rule that and have the same outcome. Now that would be, I don't want to say the extreme relief, but that would be the extreme relief. All we're asking the court to do is uphold the dismissal of the case filed under TETRA in the district court. Now, could, back to one of your questions, and if I didn't answer that last one, let me know.
But it just seems odd for a court to conclude, I don't have jurisdiction, and for us to say, yes, you did, and this is how you should have decided it.
I've had past decisions go up on appeal where this body, no one involved here, has said, we're sending it back the exact opposite ruling.
Well, that's called a reversal. I mean, that happens sometimes.
That wasn't just a reversal. That was an extreme opposite outcome.
Gotcha.
Factual issue. That was a factual type case. So.
Right, but typically that's the district court addressed the theories and the court reviews the merits of the district court's analysis and determines, no, we think you erred. And so analyzing it under the same principles that the district court analyzed it, and it's rare, but it can be, okay, we're not only going to reverse the order, we're going to direct you to enter summary judgment in favor of the other party because there were cross motions or whatever. But this is different. I think what Justice Mohler is getting to is you're asking us essentially to affirm on a basis that the district court did not address at all. And I'm struggling with that on a 12B motion where there's no supporting evidence And you're asking us to conclude, just based solely on the petition, that the theories aren't viable when I'm not sure, totally understand where you're coming from, that these divorce principles of community property should not apply here, but I don't know that you've cited us to any case law on that. And then on top of that, we've got the motion to amend, where I'm struggling with how can we decide a 12B, essentially a 12B6 basis to deny the motion to amend when I look at the papers opposing the motion to amend, and it's based entirely on the claims in the original petition that you can't transmute a separate property asset to a community property asset following death of one of the parties, which is different than the ouster, for example, in the amended petition. I'm sharing Justice Mueller's concern that we're being asked to decide a lot of things in the first instance that weren't the basis at all for why the district court dismissed the case and denied the motion to amend.
So just to address the question, the standard for an amendment is the abuse of discretion.
Right.
And under the case law, the amendment has to propose alleged facts that would support a pled recognized cause of action, which if true would entitle someone to.
And my struggle is under the abuse of discretion standard, I have no idea why the district court denied the motion to amend. It appears it was wrapped up in the I don't have jurisdiction as opposed to any analysis of the merits of the amended complaint. So I don't know how I can do an abuse of discretion review without understanding the reasons why the motion to amend was denied.
Certainly there's the four-part test.
Right.
And why wouldn't the ouster claim take us outside the original pleading either? I mean, doesn't the ouster claim raise a whole different kettle of fish?
Yes. An ouster claim, as indicated, we don't have an actual allegation of facts of ouster. And the pleading is basically, I've been ousted without any showing as to what the basis, the cause of action for ouster is. I was in possession, I was removed. That the assertion orally with no verified complaint, no affidavit that we hear is, he has a life estate and they're renting it out. Well, can't the estate during the administration of the estate rent out any asset, collect the funds? If there's liabilities that have to be satisfied, those be satisfied. But potentially that pool of money created by the rental gets distributed to him in the end. So.
But for 12B6 purposes, why isn't the allegation I have a life estate and you're renting it to someone else enough for pleading purposes under 12B6?
That's why I say I don't think it's enough to say you're renting it. You have to say you're renting it and prohibiting me from getting possession and prohibiting me from renting it.
But if you're renting it, isn't the implication I can't live there because somebody you're renting it to somebody else?
I think the equal implication, and what I would believe the facts are, is he has a life estate following death. He moved out and isn't doing anything with his life estate assets. So it's equally easy to conclude that the estate has a affirmative obligation not to leave it open.
And on a 12B motion, we have the obligation to construe all facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving.
That's correct. The only fact is they're renting it out. There's no assertion of improperly renting it out, keeping these. So anyway, I think those are pathways to outcome and the relief that we're seeking. So I think I ran over a lot, but I was trying to answer some questions.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
9 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple quick cleanup points here. Justice Mueller, with respect to jury demand, yes. There was a jury demand in the initial PEDRA petition. With respect to your question concerning the consolidation of proceedings, when there's a separate PEDRA action and an underlying probate, I believe that is governed by Idaho Code 1-2-2208, which is the which specifies the matters in which the district court
may assign matters to magistrates, which they may do in quote-unquote special instances, including proceedings in the probate of wills and administration of estates of decedents. So under at least the plain language of that statute, that would appear to give magistrates jurisdiction under TEDRA.
Counsel, if I could return, I'm not sure how salient of a matter it is. I've looked at I just did a search of the record looking for the word jury, and I didn't see that in the initial TEDRA position. Can you, and maybe I'm just missing it, can you cite me to where in the TEDRA petition that was?
Mm-hmm.
I would assume it would be in the prayer.
Did the top, would the caption have it? I'm sorry, I don't have it. There is a provision that relates specifically to jury demands in TEDRA, though. So TEDRA does authorize.
Certainly, TEDRA does authorize. I just didn't see a request for it, which is why I asked about it earlier.
Yeah.
And I still don't see one in there.
Right, and TEDRA requires in 15.8.2.10 that the jury, I mean, the matter has to be one that the party is entitled to a jury trial, but it also says the jury has to be demanded. And so I don't see it in the petition either.
So I would just ask, Chief, if there is a request somewhere in there that for whatever reason I haven't been able to locate, it would be nice if you could point that out in a supplementation to the record.
Yeah. Finally, with respect to the final point that was made about there not being a community property claim based on the will, the claim that's alleged here is different. Title 15 in its definition section 15-1-201 defines separate community property the same way that the domestic relations chapter does. Title 36, it incorporates those definitions in the domestic relations chapter. Or, I'm sorry, 32, it incorporates those definitions there. The claim is that the will purported to give away property that was not the decedent's. The will can only give away what the decedent has. And here, the claim is that it gave away more than that. Title 15, Chapter 3, 902C, there's this provision about how that there are separate and community, if there is separate community property in an estate, that the funds used to administer the estate can't come out of the surviving spouse's separate property. And if the claim, in other words, is akin to if the will, I'm just going to quote from the case Coney versus Dunbar, 21 Idaho 256. That holds, on the death of either husband or wife, one half of the community property goes to the survivor, subject to community debts, and the other half is subject to testamentary disposal. Here the claim is that the will purports to give away appellant's property interests in his half of the community portion of the real property, and that was not the decedent's to give away.
And I understood you earlier to say you were not making a transmutation claim.
Yeah.
But what you just argued is a transmutation claim, is it not? Because it's separately deeded. It's separate property. The presumption is separate property unless you establish. And so I'm unsure what you're arguing, because you seem to go back and forth between it's community property, at least a portion of it, and he's entitled to reimbursement for community contributions made to improve the property, but then you say you're not making a transmutation claim. So I'm having a hard time following what you are arguing.
Yeah, fair. And I agree with Mr. Finney's point. It is a lot of the case law is based on domestic relations, and so it's a lot of the tracks there. But the first one is what the claim is. Is the by operation of law, not only he, but it's a property interest in the value of the appreciation of the property due to his labor funds, the community's labor funds. And so it wouldn't be a creditor's claim. It's not a lien like in dissolution proceedings, but it's by operation of law, he has a property interest there. And if the will purported to devise more than to devise part of that, that is, it's not transmutation of the property itself, of the house, the ground it sits on, but it is the interest in the accumulated appreciation based on its labor, which is separate from the property itself. It remains her separate property.
So the house is separate, is her separate property?
Yes. The okay. claim is against the appreciation and value based on community efforts.
So the community property is what?
The amount the property has appreciated over the course of 35 years that he's maintained and improved it, half of that minus the decedent's original separate property. So minus the $40,000 of the separate property and then half of the net appreciation.
I just don't know how you divorce the value of the separate property asset from the asset itself, which is what I understand you to be arguing.
You're approaching this like a capital gains question, where you take the basis at one time and then look at the increase, and I'm not sure it works that way. Why is this just not a simple contribution claim?
It was an easy analogy just to, it is not like an investment account, but in the case law on pages 10 and 11 of the opening brief, discusses that the proportionate share is commensurate. It's not dollar for dollar, but it's commensurate to the community or the contributions of the surviving spouse's efforts. And so what that is, how that cashes out, is for a fact finder to unwind.
Very well. Counsel, thank you. Mr. Shrevin, we'll give you 7 days to supplement if you are able to do so, as was requested by Justice Zahn and Justice Moore, essentially. So this matter will not be taken under advisement until September 25th. But that will be in brief recess.
All rise, please.